last week we were talking about the Mahabharata, this great narrative of the descendants of Bharata, which we saw were two families, the sons of Pandu and the sons of Dhritarashtra. The text is really an account of the conflict that arose between these two branches of the royal family, where Dhritarashtra is the older son and was supposed to be king, but was born blind and therefore was deemed ineligible to be a king. And so the throne goes to his younger brother, Pandu, who rules, but then dies young. And then we have his five sons, Yudhishthira, the eldest son, who is portrayed as the ideal king, as the Kshatriya, the warrior, the king, who embodies fully dharma. And his younger brothers then, Arjuna and Bhima, and then two pair of twins, Nakula and Sahadeva. Who are then in conflict with Dhritarashtra's sons, led by Duryodhana. And so after the death of Pandu, Duryodhana argues that he is the proper heir to the throne because his father was supposed to be king and he's the eldest son of his father. But Pandu was king, and so Yudhishthira claims that he's the legitimate heir. And so it leads to a long conflict between the two, and the whole book of 100,000 verses is narrating that conflict. And as we've seen, in the end, this leads to a grand war between the two factions, where the entire family, including all the cousins and so on, are split between the two sides and fights this war, which is the second half of Mahabharata, is mostly about that and how the war evolves. Now, as we've seen, the Mahabharata portrays itself to be the fifth Veda. Just as traditionally the Vedas are seen to have an Upanishad associated with them, so traditionally the Mahabharata is also seen to have an Upanishad associated with it. And that Upanishad is the Bhagavad Gita. And the Bhagavad Gita are really 18 chapters of the Mahabharata narrative itself. But they come to be seen as an independent text, as a separate text that can be read on its own, even though, as we will see, that knowing the context of the Mahabharata helps to understand what the Gita is about. But there's a lot of commentaries on the Gita and very few on the Mahabharata as a whole, because this text, the Bhagavad Gita, comes to be seen as an important text in its own right and as one of the foundations for the Vedanta schools, these schools that are concerned with the interpretation of the Upanishads, where they regard this as the Upanishad of the fifth Veda, that is the Mahabharata, and therefore as a special text on its own. Now, the reason I kind of give a very brief synopsis of what we did last week when we talked about the Mahabharata is because the Bhagavad Gita, the context of the Bhagavad Gita, in order to appreciate that context, you have to know a little of the backstory there, because the Gita starts at the time, just at the moment just before the war begins, and the two armies have assembled in Kurukshetra, in a place in North India, and you have the Pandavas on one side, and Duryodhana and his allies on the other side, with their respective armies, and Arjuna, who is the brother of Yudhishthira, who is claiming the throne, or who's fighting for the throne, his chariot driver is Krishna, who, as we've seen last week, is portrayed in the text as the avatar, as the descendant of Vishnu, who appears in this world to uphold dharma and to vanquish adharma. And the story goes in the Mahabharata that Krishna, he's himself a Kshatriya, he's himself a warrior, and he decides to be impartial in the war. And so he offers to both sides, he says, there's two things that I'm offering you. One is you can have my army, or if you do not want my army, you can have me, but I will not take up arms. I will not directly fight in this war. And the Pandavas choose Krishna, and Krishna becomes the charioteer of Arjuna, who drives him through the battlefield, through the war. And Dhritarashtra chooses Krishna's army. Now, at the beginning, the very opening of the Bhagavad Gita, the armies have assembled, and Arjuna asks Krishna, he says, please drive my chariot in between the two armies so I can see who has come to fight this war, to fight against us. And so Krishna drives him in between the two armies, and Arjuna looks at the opposing army, and what he sees is not just his relatives, Duryodhana and so on are his cousins, but also his teachers are there, principally his military teacher, Drona, and the sort of the grandsire of the family, a person called Bhishma. And Arjuna sees his relatives and his friends and his teachers assembled on the opposing side of the battlefield, and he realizes that, how can I fight this war? Because for me to fight in this war would be to kill my superiors, to kill my relatives, and this goes against every principle of Dharma. He also argues that if I fight in this war, a lot of people will die, all these soldiers will die, which will lead to the instability in society, and which will lead to the degradation of society as a whole. And therefore, he says, it is better for me to renounce this whole war, to leave this battlefield, to live like a mendicant, like an ascetic, and to beg for my livelihood than to fight in this war. And in presenting his arguments, interestingly enough, Arjuna really echoes a lot of the comments that Yudhishthira makes about the dharma of a kshatriya, the dharma of a warrior, and his views on war. A lot of what Arjuna says is what Yudhishthira says throughout the Mahabharata. And it's at the end of the first chapter of the Gita, Arjuna says, I will not fight. He throws down his bow, and he then turns to Krishna, and he says, actually, I do not know what is best, so please tell me what I should do in this situation. And the Gita is really a response to Arjuna's dilemma, and is an attempt to teach Arjuna the proper principles of Dharma and to teach him what is appropriate to act in this context. Now, in order to understand that, it's kind of important to stress that the Mahabharata, I mean, the Gita is a part of the Mahabharata, and what has preceded the Mahabharata is a long a long account of various attempts in which the Pandavas and particularly Krishna have attempted to prevent this war from happening. As we've seen last week, Yudhishthira and Bhishma as well, actually, there's an important section in the Mahabharata that occurs after the Bhagavad Gita, which is at the end of the war. Bhishma is mortally wounded and he lies on a bed of arrows. He's pierced with arrows, but he was given the boon that he could choose the moment of his death. So he's awaiting an auspicious time to die. And after the war, Yudhishthira goes to Bhishma and asks for Bhishma's instructions on dharma in general. And a large part of the Mahabharata is Bhishma's teachings to Yudhishthira. And one of the key teachings of Bhishma there is that ahimsa, non-violence, is the highest dharma. Anything that goes against ahimsa is breaking with dharma, which kind of seems odd then to have a text like the Bhagavad Gita in the middle of that grand text, where Krishna will tell Arjuna that it is your duty to fight here. It is your duty to take up arms and fight this war, and there is no alternative for you but to fight. And part of this is to do with the backstory that all other means have been have failed, all other attempts to prevent this war have failed through diplomacy and so on. Everything has failed. Duryodhana is set on ostracizing the Pandavas, the son of Pandu, from the kingdom, and therefore war is the final alternative, the final option on the table here. But partly also, as we will see, what Krishna's argument is really, it's not an argument about war. And the text, although Krishna tells Arjuna to fight, it's really the fact that he's fighting in a war is almost incidental to the teachings of Krishna during throughout the Gita. And this is important to keep in mind, because in more modern times, the Gita has sometimes been used by some people as sort of a call for a fight to take up arms to defend the sort of dharma through some form of military means. Whereas traditionally, the Gita has never been read like this. You can read commentary after commentary on the Gita, and no one really talks about war. Because the theme of the Gita is really about dharma, and the fact that Arjuna's dharma happens to be war is kind of almost an afterthought for most commentators. And the way Krishna responds to Arjuna's dilemma, Arjuna tells him, "I will not fight, but please instruct me what I should do instead." And Krishna immediately, the first thing he says is, "You think you're very wise, but everything you say betrays your ignorance." Krishna starts with a very Upanishadic approach to the issue. He starts by saying, what you're seeing here, the people you're seeing on the other side of the battlefield, you yourself and I, none of us are what you think we are. These people are not your relatives. These people are not subject to death, because everyone is the Atman, the undying, eternal self, which has no beginning and has no end and cannot be killed and cannot kill either. And therefore, he starts kind of from a very philosophical perspective and says, none of what you're thinking of is worthy of conversation, really, because you're thinking on a bodily level. You're thinking on the sort of the, if you think of the what we were talking about some weeks ago, of the Taittiriya Upanishad sort of layered self, where the outward self, the outermost self, is the body, whereas the inner self would be the Atman. And so he's saying, you're just thinking very superficially here. But once you understand that that you are not the body that you inhabit, but you're the undying self within the body, you will become free from any lamentation, any grief, any desire, and so on, that you obtain, that you would otherwise obtain in the context of this war. You have a few passages here from the opening of Krishna's argument on the second page of the handout. where he says, the Lord said, Krishna said, "Whilst grieving for those who should not be lamented over, you speak words that appear wise." This is under the eternal self, Bhagavad Gita 2:11-22. "But learned men grieve for neither the living nor the dead. There was never a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor these lords of men, these kings that have assembled to fight, nor shall any of us cease to exist in the future. Even as the embodied soul present in this body goes through childhood, youth, and then old age, in the same way it then acquires a different body. One who is wise is not confused about this. It is contact of the senses with their objects," Kamteya, son of Kunti, Arjuna's mother, "which leads to sensations of heat and cold, pleasure and pain. Being impermanent, such sensations come and go, and so you must learn to endure them, O Bharata," O descendant of Bharata, who's the sort of ancestor of the whole family. if these sensations do not distract a person, O best of men, and if he can remain equal in sorrow and happiness, then such a wise person gains the state of immortality. That which is unreal never comes into being, and that which is real never ceases to be, the unreal being the body, which is unreal because it has no permanent reality, it's constantly changing, and therefore it can be considered to be not coming into being as being unexisting, and the real never ceases to be, the real being the self. Those who perceive the truth can recognize this conclusion concerning these two. And as if you skip a few verses, well, actually one verse, 2:19, neither the person who thinks this self is the killer, nor he who thinks it is killed properly understands it, for it does not kill and it cannot be killed. It is never born and it never dies. It is existing now and it will never cease to exist. It is unborn, eternal, everlasting, and most ancient. It is not killed when the body is killed. The message that Krishna starts out with is something that we've kind of seen in the more ascetic traditions, and these ascetic texts that have a similar approach, that say all the changes we see, all the concerns with dharma that the ritualists have and so on, these are all superficial concerns because these have concerns that have to do with the body. But one who knows the nature of the self is neither happy nor sad, is above all these dualities that we find in this world, and therefore Krishna says this is where you should be focusing on. This is what you how you should look at things. And throughout the first six chapters of the Gita, Krishna keeps coming back to points like this, and Arjuna keeps being confused because Arjuna keeps thinking that what I decided to do was I decided that this was adharmic to fight in this war. Therefore, I decided to renounce and become an ascetic. And Krishna has told me that this was ignorance. This was a desire that was rooted in ignorance, and this was the wrong thing to do. And yet, time and time again, he seems to tell me that this ascetic thing is the way to go, as we have in these passages, where he says, you should not think on these levels. And what Krishna actually is trying to teach to Arjuna, and what takes Arjuna six chapters before he gets it, is that he takes this sort of emphasis on the self of the ascetic traditions and says, yes, the bodies we inhabit are temporary, and therefore everything that comes with the body is temporary. And therefore all the concerns that come with, that are related to the body are of no real interest. And we should be focused on the self, and we should turn within, and we should find pleasure in the self and not outwardly, and we should therefore become free from the desire to obtain anything in this world, and free from the aversion to obtain something that is unpleasurable in this world. And Krishna teaches that, but what is unique about the Gita is that Krishna teaches that, and he starts with that, but he keeps clarifying his position, and he keeps telling Arjuna, you know, even though this is all true, it is important that you fight in this war. And this is what confuses Arjuna. How do the two go together? What kind of a teaching is this? But what Krishna is teaching, what the Gita is teaching, is that he says, yes, you are the self. And yes, the self is unchanging. And yes, everything that to do with the body is impermanent. And yes, everything to do with the self is way more important than anything to do with the body. But you have a body, and you are embodied, and it is because you are embodied that you cannot but act. And therefore, the question is not whether I should renounce or should engage in this war, but the question is, how do I have to engage in this war? And there's one verse that is repeated in the Gita entirely, and that is the verse where Krishna says that an embodied being cannot but act. An embodied being has to act because the body forces the embodied being to act. And so where Krishna goes with this is he's saying that you're thinking it is better to be inactive and to renounce the world and to live an ascetic life of inactivity. But he says within that inactivity is action. Whereas what I'm teaching is if you learn to act in the proper way, then within your action, there is inaction. You have a passage there, if you turn the page to the third page, get a section there of action and inaction. sorry, the verse numbers are slightly off, but you have the verse numbers in the top of the section there. This is from chapter 4, where he says, "One who perceives inaction in action and action in inaction is intelligent amongst men. He's properly engaged and he performs all his designated actions. When all a person's endeavors are devoid of any inclination towards desire, his action is burnt by the fire of knowledge. The wise ones describe such a person as a learned pundit, as a wise man. When a person gives up attachment for the fruits of action, is always satisfied and is not dependent on any other, then even though he's engaged in action, he performs no action at all. Having no expectation of results, controlling his thoughts, practicing self-control, giving up all desire for acquisitions, and acting only for the maintenance of the body, a person remains free of contamination. If he's satisfied with whatever befalls him, transcends duality, is free of envy, and is equal in success and failure, then even though he engages in action, he's not bound by it." And so, what the Gita is teaching is that the action in itself is not the problem. And so there is a sort of an implied criticism, actually at times it is not implied, it's quite direct, of those who hold to these ascetic views that we've seen before, where they say we have to renounce the world, we have to come to a state of total inaction, because whatever action we perform causes bondage in this world, causes our rebirth. Whereas the Gita is saying, this is not actually the case. What is important is that, yes, we are the self, but yes, we have a body, and therefore we have to act with this body. But the problem is not the action itself, but the problem is desire. And it is the desire that lies at the root of action that is the problem that we have to transcend. And it's the desire that causes action to be considered action, in the sense of that causes action to have these binding consequences, that causes rebirth, and that causes the sort of the performance of further action. And so his Krishna's argument is that the ascetics, they renounce the world, they choose a life of inactivity, but as long as desire is there, they will remain active. And he talks of these people who have renounced the world, who are active within, because their desires are still within, present within their minds, and therefore, even though they cease to act externally, it is as if they are still acting. They might as well act in this world, and instead it would be a better thing for them to be honest and continue acting in this world. And so what Krishna teaches Arjuna is that you are trying to escape action, but you cannot escape action because action is intrinsic to the embodied being. And therefore, what you have to do is learn to act without desire. And you learn to act without desire, not in the sense that you act in, you don't care, what you do, but rather you're acting without the desire for the fruits of your action, for the results of your action. And this is one of the trickiest parts of the Gita, and probably one of the most misunderstood ones, where Krishna is not teaching Arjuna that you can just, Krishna is teaching Arjuna to be responsible and to act in a dharmic way, but to act in such a way that he's not concerned he's not concerned with whatever the result of that action will be. So he should act in accordance with Dharma because that is the dharmic thing to do. But whether this war between him and his cousins will lead to victory on his side or will lead to defeat, he says that you should learn to transcend because that is not in your control. And so whether you will win this war, whether you will die in this war, that is of no concern to you. The only thing that is of concern to you is acting in this moment, in the appropriate way, in a dharmic way. And if you do that, if you give up that desire for whatever positive or the desire for the absence of the negative result that will come, your action is really inaction, because desire is the root of all action. And so what the Gita is doing, and if you think of the things we've seen in the last few weeks, the big opposites you have between the ritualists, those concerned with dharma, who say you have to act in the world, it is all about proper action in the world, and the ascetics who are saying all of that is a product of ignorance. You have to realize the nature of the self. You have to move away from it. What the Gita is doing is bringing those two together and saying, yes, you have to act in the world, but yes, you also have to be renounced, and you have to be detached from the things in this world. But being detached from the things in this world is not obtained by stepping outside of society, but rather is obtained by acting within society, but becoming detached from the results of your action. And so it's an attempt to internalize that renunciation, to turn that renunciation within. And it is only by doing that, Krishna argues, that work, that action will not bind you, that you can be active in the world and yet strive for liberation as well. And this is a theme that the Mahabharata itself addresses as well, where particularly in the teachings of Bhishma on his deathbed to Yudhishthira, where you have the notion of a moksha dharma. And indeed, a large part of the Mahabharata is called the moksha dharma. And it's the idea is that there's a way in which you can pursue dharma, not as a way of attaining the world of the gods and attaining heaven that the ritualists are concerned with, but that there's a way you can pursue dharma and obtain moksha and attain liberation from rebirth. And Yudhishthira is the person who embodies this most fully in the Mahabharata, who's always portrayed as this. And the basic idea of this is that what this means is that if you remember the four varnas, so we have the Brahmanas, the Kshatriyas, the priests, the warriors and kings, the Vaishyas, the merchants and traders and agriculture, farmers and so on, and the Shudras, the laborers. As we've seen in the Dharma Shastras, each of these is said to have its own dharma. You know, what is the dharma for a Brahman is not the same as what is dharma for the Kshatriyas and so on. And basically the idea of moksha dharma is taking these brahminical dharmic principles, particularly the sort of the more ethical side of it, compassion, non-violence, equanimity, and so on, all these values that are associated with Brahmanas, and applying them to the other varnas, and saying that if you pursue these virtues, if you pursue these ethical standards, then you can engage in whatever it is you're doing in this world. And that is a way in which you can then attain moksha, attain liberation by being active in the world. And so the Gita is building on this notion of moksha dharma that is found in the Mahabharata, but adds a more robust sort of rationale to it, where the principal obstacle is desire. Once desire is eradicated, then you can be inactive even while acting. It is something the Dharma Shastras actually respond to. You have some Dharma Shastras who argue you cannot act without desire. This is a ludicrous idea, because whatever you do is performed out of the desire for an outcome. To act without desire is a contradiction in terms. But the Gita's viewpoint is not so much that it is, you know, obviously the Gita is saying you desire to act in a particular way, and sort of there is that intention and desire that is at the root of your action. But it's not desire in itself, but it's desire for the results of the action that is the problem. And it's, or as the Gita sometimes puts it, it is attachment to the results of the action that is the problem. And Arjuna, to act in a dharmic way in this war, has to fight, and has to fight giving his all to this fight, and therefore has to fight in such a way as to win. But whether he will win or not, that is not up to him. That is beyond his control. And so therefore his attachment to winning in this war, that is the cause of his bondage to action. And therefore if he can say, I will give my all to this, but whether I will win or whether I will lose, I do not care about that result when it comes. that is actually a freedom, and that is actually a state of inaction. That's the way that the Gita portrays it. As you get there in the citation below that, from the very first verse of the sixth chapter of the Gita, Krishna says, "A person who performs the action he is duty-bound to perform, whilst remaining detached from the fruit of action, is a true renunciant, a true sannyasi, a true ascetic, and a yogi, not one who never lights the sacrificial fire and does not perform ritual." If you remember, the ascetics, they cannot light the sacrificial fire because they're ritually dead. They've internalized the sacrificial fire. And therefore, he says, these people are not true ascetics, but the true ascetic is one who is duty-bound to act, who acts out of dharma, and is at the same time detached from the results of his action. Now, this in a way, is the teaching of the first six chapters of the Gita, and it takes six chapters to articulate this position, because Arjuna keeps being confused and keeps saying, you're telling me to be renounced and be detached, and yet at the same time you're telling me to act here in this war. How can I understand this? You're just confusing me. And Krishna keeps clarifying his position. But in a sense, these teachings are presented in the six chapters are really just the foundation for everything that is to come afterwards. And one of the remarkable things about these six chapters is, if you think about the Upanishads, talk about the Atman, talk about the self, and teach the self as our true identity. And this is what Krishna is doing in these early chapters, particularly in the second chapter. This is how he starts, as we've seen. But the Upanishads also say that we have to go one step further, and we have to then understand that the Atman, the self, is in some way related, or some way finds its identity in Brahman, which is our true self. In the first six chapters of the Gita, there's hardly any mention to this notion of Brahman. There's a few a passing reference to it. There's a little sort of digression into the nature of Krishna as the avatar in the beginning of chapter 4. But apart from that, there's no real discussion of the nature of Brahman. And Krishna only brings that in the middle six chapters of the Gita. And it's chapter 7 to chapter 12, where he then introduces this idea of Brahman. And again, he's building on Upanishadic ideas and reinterpreting some Upanishadic ideas and incorporating even some entire verses from some of the Upanishads. Now, if you remember from when we were talking about the Upanishads, there are, as I said then, there are two sort of main types of Upanishads, or two ways in which the Upanishads think of the relationship between Atman and Brahman, or two ways in which the Upanishads think about the nature of Brahman. One is the way we've perhaps mostly focused on now, which is the notion that Brahman is the foundation of all existence and is of the nature of consciousness. And what we have to realize is that we experience ourselves now as individual consciousness, but we are actually part of that universal consciousness that lies at the foundation of all existence. And the Upanishads are trying to teach us that and help us to come to that point. But there's some Upanishads have don't fundamentally disagree with this, but add something to this, or see the nature of Brahman somewhat differently, where Brahman comes to be seen as, in a theistic sense, as God with a capital G, where we find our existence in Brahman, in God, because we have no existence separately from God. Everything exists within God. God is being itself, and therefore contains everything that exists within himself. And we, in those other Upanishads, we have our own individuality, but our individuality is to realize our true individuality, is to realize our groundedness in Brahman, in God. And you have a few passages from these Upanishads on the very beginning of the handout. And the main Upanishads that teach that are the Katha Upanishad and the Mundaka Upanishad. The Mundaka we've seen before is this very anti-ritual Upanishad. And there's another one that's important for this as well, and that is the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. And it's particularly those first two that the Gita is quite close to, and there's a number of verses from both these Upanishads that occur either verbatim or with some slight changes in the Gita in Krishna's own teachings. And what these Upanishads are saying is, you have there in the beginning of the handout, is they're saying Brahman is theistic, and because Brahman is theistic, therefore this whole process of our self-realization, our attempt to understand our true nature and to understand our Brahman, is different from the other Upanishads that say Brahman is non-theistic. Brahman is non-dual in an absolute sense, and has no differentiation within it, and we have to realize that in order to realize our true self. Because if Brahman is God, it means that there's an element of grace that comes in. And therefore the attainment of Brahman and the attainment of knowledge of Brahman is not just due to our endeavor, is not just up to our endeavor, but is also can be aided by the self-revelation of God to us. And so you have a few passages there from these theistic Upanishads in the beginning of this verse that occurs both in the Katha and the Mundaka Upanishad. It says this self, and here these Upanishads often use the term the self to refer to Brahman as the ultimate self of us, as the person in whom we ultimately find our identity. This self cannot be attained by instruction, nor by intellectual power, nor even through hearing the Upanishad acknowledge. He is to be attained only by one whom the self chooses. To such a one, the self reveals his own nature. And you have, if you go two down to that, these verses from the Mundaka Upanishad, which has this very interesting image of two birds, companions and friends, nested on the very same tree. One of them eats a tasty fig, the other, not eating, looks on, stuck on the very same tree. One person grieves, deluded by her who is not the Lord. Her who is not the Lord is matter. Matter is feminine in Sanskrit. But when he sees the other, the contented Lord and his majesty, his grief disappears. When the seer sees that person, the golden colored, the creator, the Lord, as the womb of Brahman, then shaking off the good and the bad, the wise man becomes spotless and attains the highest identity. It doesn't say he attains oneness with the Lord, the creator, the golden colored one, but he attains the highest identity in the sense that he's established in that divine identity. He attains, literally, to the highest sameness. You become sort of equal, on an equal level to Brahman, not in the sense that you become Brahman, but you are on sort of an equal footing, and therefore you can have a relationship that is a relationship of equals in the state of liberation. And so the image you have here of the tree is the tree of the body, and we have the two birds that are in the tree. One of the birds is us, and we're hopping around from branch to branch, eating the figs of the tree, and we are, as it says there, we're grieving, we're experiencing the joy of eating the fig, but also the sorrow of eating a rotten fig or something like that. And the other bird that accompanies us in this body is this Brahman, who in the Mundaka Upanishad and the Shvetashvatara Upanishad is often called Purusha, a term we've already seen in the context of Vedic ritual, in the context of the Purusha Sukta. But here Purusha literally means person. And so this other bird that accompanies us is God, who witnesses all our actions. And what we need to do is to turn to that person instead of turning outwardly to the figs in the tree. And if we do, then, as it says here, when he sees the other, the contented Lord and his majesty, his grief disappears, and we will attain the highest sameness. By the way, we won't have time to read through it, but the passage you have below there from the Shvetashvatara Upanishad kind of builds on this idea and really makes a very explicit reference to the notion of the Purusha in this sense, and the Purusha of the Purusha Sukta, or the Purusha of the Purusha Sukta, which in, according to the ritualist, the personification of ritual here is sort of seen as the creator of the world, as God, who is present in all of creation, and so on. So the use of the term is not sort of incidental, or is very a conscious use of that term from those ritualists to point to the same thing as the other Upanishads, who is as Brahman being the power beyond the ritual, and so on. What the Gita does with all these ideas is it brings all these ideas in after it is established in the idea of inaction, where it says then, okay, what you have to do is you have to act in a detached way. You have to act by being detached from the results of the action. And that allows you to be established in the self, and not be swayed by desires that are products of the body, and the attachment of the things related to the body. And in the middle six chapters, it then sort of says, okay, that's all good and well, but where is Brahman in all this? And it builds then on this, and Krishna then says, having understood this, what you should then do is you should act in accordance with your nature, because you are of the nature of a Kshatriya. You're born with the body of a Kshatriya. Therefore, you cannot act but by acting as a Kshatriya. It is your dharma to act as a Kshatriya. Therefore, this is the only appropriate means to act. But if you do this without desire, you're not bound. But then, if you then do that in relation to Brahman, in relation to God, you lift that up one step higher. You go one step beyond that. And you act not just out of a sense of duty, not just detached from the results of your action, but you do this as an offering to God. And whatever you do it as an offering to, well, Krishna says to me, because he's portrayed in the Mahabharata as the avatar of Vishnu, and Vishnu is identified with Brahman throughout the Mahabharata and throughout the Gita. And therefore he's saying, this is the higher dharma. And we've seen this last week already, where Krishna kind of comes into the Mahabharata, and he's the avatar, he's the descendant of Vishnu, who's there to uphold dharma. And yet, as we've seen, a lot of what he does seems to go against the principles of dharma. He advises the Pandavas, the Arjuna and his brothers, to break dharma in fighting the war. If you remember, he tells Yudhishthira, Drona is wiping out the army of the Pandavas, and Krishna says, well, we have to stop Drona from fighting, and he will only fight if he thinks his son is dead. And therefore he tells Yudhishthira, if you go, you, the perfect dharmic person who would never utter a lie, if you go to Drona and tell him his son is dead, Ashwatthama, his son is dead, then he will believe you, he will cease fighting, and we have a chance to win this war, he's saying, which is kind of going against all principles of dharma, it seems. But what the Mahabharata is teaching in that is that the highest dharma dharma is not just established by the sort of, the dharma shastras, and by sort of an impersonal sort of, set of rules, but rather ultimately dharma is that which is ordained by God, and therefore this is the highest dharma, and therefore Yudhishthira telling a lie is not considered a breaking of dharma, because he fulfills a higher dharma. And so the same idea we get in the middle six chapters of the Gita, where Krishna says, okay, you act without desire for the results of your action, but you do those actions then as an offering to me. Whatever the outcome of the action will be, you leave that up to me, and that is true detachment. And what we get here is a new idea we have not seen before, and that is the notion of bhakti. And bhakti is often translated as devotion, which is slightly misleading, because devotion kind of has the connotation of being an emotion that you feel, whereas in Sanskrit, bhakti is actually something that you do. It's an action that you perform. And so it's more sort of devotional action, or an action that is done out of love for God, where you have this sort of foundation in the Upanishadic ideas of the personal Brahman, of the theistic understanding of Brahman. And rather than attaining Brahman merely by coming to understand the nature of Brahman through the Upanishadic knowledge, you come to attain Brahman by acting in a relationship with Brahman, by acting out of love for Brahman. And so whatever it is that you do that out of love for Brahman, for God, by offering things, the results of your actions to him. And so the Gita, in some sense, it is saying that, yes, all these principles of Dharma are there, and yes, Arjuna, you have a body of a Kshatriya, and therefore you cannot renounce this and think that you will then come to act in a different way, because the nature of your body is such that it will force you to act as a Kshatriya will act, and therefore you should act, but you should act without desire. But ultimately, it is coming to the point that you should act because I desire you to act. You should act as in reciprocation with this, with me in this relationship that we have. And this is what Krishna is teaching in the middle chapters of the Gita, where he reveals his own divinity to Arjuna. The passage that most Western readers consider to be sort of the epitome of the Gita, the chapter most Indian commentators kind of go like, okay, yeah, fine, let's move on, is the chapter where Krishna reveals his divinity to Arjuna in a grand way, where he shows himself to be the Purusha of the Purusha Sukta, where, if you remember, the Purusha Sukta starts with, you know, he has 1,000 hands, 1,000 arms, 1,000 eyes, and so on. Basically, his sort of, he encompasses everything within this world, and Krishna reveals his Virat Rupa, his cosmic form, showing that everything is contained within him, both past, present, and future, that everything that happens within the world, everything that is going to be the outcome of the war, is already kind of, you know, revealed in that cosmic form, which transcends time and space. Arjuna's response to that is a response of utter terror, where he realizes, oh my God, this is my friend, this is the person I've behaved so casually with, that we've joked about and I've teased him and so on, and now he reveals to me that he is, you know, everything in existence, and he begs Krishna for forgiveness, and he says, please, you know, reveal your form as Krishna again, so I can relate to you again. And Krishna does, and then sort of the teachings of the Gita go on. It's kind of sort of this brief interlude in between that. But it's an important passage, because it sort of establishes the identity of Krishna in relation to the sort of Upanishadic ideas of the Katha and the Mundaka Upanishad. But in a sense of, in the structure of the Gita, it's in sort of in the narrative of the teachings, it's sort of this brief interlude that's then almost forgotten in the later chapters. And one of the implications of this notion of bhakti that Krishna teaches is, Krishna contrasts this path of bhakti, this path of loving action, with the worship of the ritualists throughout the Gita, particularly these middle chapters, where he's saying that these ritualists, they're also worshipping deities, but this is a totally different form of worship that they're engaging in. Their worship is ritualistic, their worship is pursued in order to fulfill their desires, whereas those who worship me do so not out of desire, but do so purely out of love for me. And therefore, this is of a different nature. This is of a different nature too, because the gods that are worshipped through ritual are subject to death as well, or within this world of matter. Krishna says, I exist beyond the world of matter. I'm the source of everything within this world. And therefore, their worship is performed out of a small-mindedness, not knowing that the bigger picture, whereas those who worship me do so with full understanding of the nature of reality. But perhaps more importantly, one of the things Krishna then also stresses is that the path of the Vedic ritualist is limited to those who are twice born, to those Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas who have undergone Vedic initiation and have studied the Vedas and have become eligible to perform Vedic rituals, but also is limited to those who are male. Women cannot perform Vedic rituals independently of their husbands. They can only do so in support of their husband's ritual performance. Whereas Krishna says, those who pursue bhakti, all of these things are of no consequence. And this is, again, somewhat similar to the Mahabharata itself, which we have seen declares itself to be the fifth Veda, but it is the fifth Veda that is accessible to all, that is accessible to women, that is accessible to Shudras as well, to the laborers who were excluded from Vedic study. And similarly, the Gita stresses that bhakti is not dependent on a particular birth in a particular community, but anyone can pursue this. And therefore, in a sense, what it is doing too is kind of opening up this Upanishadic knowledge as well. If you remember, the Upanishads are very firmly rooted in the Vedic worldview, and all the participants in Upanishadic debate and instruction are all Vedic ritualists themselves, whereas Krishna is saying, yes, all this knowledge is wonderful, but all this knowledge culminates in bhakti, and bhakti is accessible to anyone. It does not require a purity of birth. It does not require whether you're man or woman. It has no consequence on this, because this is something that transcends all this. This has to do with the. This is a response of the or is action on the level of the self in relation to Brahman, whereas all the concerns of the ritualist are concerns with the body of the self, which is temporary. And so you may be a woman now, but next birth you might be a man. You may be a Brahmin now, but you might be a Shudra in your next life, and so on. And so these things keep changing. And as he says in the beginning, the wise do not pay attention to the things that are changing, but focus on that which is unchanging, which is the nature of the self, which is neither Brahmin nor Shudra, nor man nor woman, and therefore is open to the pursue the bhakti, irrespective of any other conditions. The final chapters of the Gita, the final six chapters of the Gita, are kind of a variety of teachings that Krishna offers that are more or less building on some of the earlier days. He sort of revisits a number of the earlier teachings, but come to stress bhakti more and more. And the final teaching that Krishna gives Arjuna is a verse that becomes very important for some of the traditions we will look at in next term. Is a tradition that teaches that comes to be known as prapatti, which is radical surrender, where Krishna finally teaches and says, "Give up all dharma and seek refuge only in me. I will deliver you from all evil reactions that might come from performing or not performing action. Do not fear." This is the final teaching that Krishna gives, which teaches this notion of radical surrender, radical abandonment to God as a path to salvation. But anyway, we'll come back to this in next term. The final thing Arjuna says, Krishna tells Arjuna after having taught the whole Gita, he says, "Well, here's what I have to say. Now you do as you like." And Arjuna says, "Fine, I will fight this war." And he fights the war, and they win the war, and Yudhishthira becomes king, and as we've seen last week, Yudhishthira is really impressed by being king, because he realizes all the suffering that caused him, that occurred to put him on the throne, and in a sense, again, it's kind of the paradox of the Mahabharata. It is this text about war, and yet the chief characters in the text, particularly Arjuna and Yudhishthira, are those who are most reluctant to fight this war. And it is because they're most reluctant to fight this war that they're portrayed as the ideal warriors, as the ideal Kshatriyas. It is because Yudhishthira least desires to be king. Therefore, he's the proper person to be king, because he has all the virtues that are necessary for this moksha dharma, for this dharma that leads to liberation within himself. And so similarly, Arjuna, having heard the Gita, he says, now I understand what it is that I should do, and therefore I will engage in this, I will fight in this battle, and that is the end of the Gita. Now, as I said earlier, you know, in a sense, Krishna is telling Arjuna to fight, but Krishna is telling Arjuna to fight because that happens to be the action that he needs to take right now. Traditional commentators have always sort of ignored that part, more or less, and focused on the underlying principle of this, of action in inaction, the root of desire, or desires being the root of all action, and the importance of bhakti, of devotion. It's this notion of bhakti that comes to dominate a lot of traditions that we look at in Hinduism too in the next term, that sort of takes various forms, and that comes to be interpreted in various ways, some in very radically sort of countercultural ways, and sort of overthrowing the traditional order of society, some kind of thinking of that very much within this context of dharma, but that we'll see next term. Next week we will look at some texts that focus on on this notion of bhakti, which are the Puranas, these narrative texts are really the heart of all Hindu mythological sort of stories. Their origin is there, but they do so. At least the more influential ones do so within a framework of bhakti. And so we'll look at those next week. So there you have it. Something of the Gita. The Gita is a relatively short text. It's like 700 verses long. There's quite a few translations around. Without a doubt, the most widely translated Indian text. It's worth reading, it doesn't take that long. Hopefully I've not discouraged you from doing that.